your favorite source for Chicago White Sox talk, delivering news, interviews, analysis, and more. This is the Sox Machine Podcast with your hosts, Jim Margulis, James Fegan, and Josh Nelson.
Thanks, Rob, and welcome to a new episode of the Sox Machine Podcast. I'm your host, Josh Nelson, and it's Sunday, July 6, 2025, as we record this new episode. The Chicago White Sox wrapped up their West Coast road trip, getting swept by the Los Angeles Dodgers to start, which wasn't a surprise. But they almost swept the Colorado Rockies, but they did settle for another road series win, so they go 2-4 visiting Los Angeles and Denver. This weekend is highlighted by the promotion of Colson Montgomery, and he did make a great first impression in his first three games of the major leagues. We'll recap Montgomery's MLB debut. Shane Smith is officially an all-star, which is great, but is he running out of gas because his last few starts have not been good? The White Sox have a very festive homestand coming up, but they'll start against the Toronto Blue Jays this week before the all-star break. Around Major League Baseball, the Washington Nationals fired their general manager, Mike Rizzo, a week before they make the first pick overall in the MLB draft. What is going on in D.C.? And we'll catch up what else is going on around Major League Baseball. But we start this show on a somber note. Bobby Jenks, former closer of the Chicago White Sox and recorded a save in Game 4 of the 2005 World Series, passed away due to stomach cancer at age 44. In a feature story on The Athletic written by Sam Blum this past April, Jenks made it a goal to return to Chicago and be part of the 2005 World Series celebrations that will be taking place next weekend on July 11th through the 13th. In six seasons with the Chicago White Sox, Jenks appeared in 329 games. He recorded 173 saves. He was a two-time All-Star back in 2006 and 2007. He picked up four saves during the 2005 postseason, two of those in the World Series. He did record the save in the White Sox lone playoff win in the 2008 postseason. And from his personal standpoint, from his Major League Baseball career, in 2007, Bobby Jenks tied then a Major League Baseball record of retiring 41 straight batters July 17th through August 12th. Joining me now to remember Bobby Jenks is Sox Machine's beat reporter James Fegan and managing editor Jim Margulis. And Jim, every professional sports championship winning team has a cult hero. And when it comes to the 2005 White Sox, I feel like Bobby Jenks is one of them because he came out of nowhere late in the season and he was huge in the postseason, making a lasting impact.
Yeah, the White Sox had a few of those guys who met that description just because of all the corners of the baseball world, and in some cases, in the case of like Tadahito Oguchi, the actual world just kind of converged on Chicago to fulfill very specific, very important roles. But yeah, Jenks was certainly the latest arriving, certainly from the most obscure, I guess, parts of like, you know, being kicked out of the Angels basically, versus like being a star in Japan or being, you know, a 1 year signing. Like Jenks was, I guess the project was abandoned by the Angels just because of alcohol issues and just, you know, immaturity and thinking like, this guy's not coachable. And all of a sudden, like, he shows the White Sox and, you know, give him a couple months and then he's all of a sudden the team's third closer of the season and saving, you know, the most important games of the year and saving them very well, hitting like kind of like Grant Taylor, hitting new heights on the radar gun for that season right out of the gate. So I think he speaks to how charmed that season was, that despite, you know, the health problems he had, despite the off the field problems he had, that he was able to at least contain them. And also, I think, you know, probably Ozzie Guillen. We know that over the years that he and Jenks kind of butted heads. And I think Guillen did a great job of managing Jenks's immaturity at points. I think it's a good general catch-all term for the problems he had, whether it was problems of Ozzie not liking the way Ozzie was managing him versus, you know, some of the things that some of Ozzie's family would suggest on social media later about Jenks's conduct. That sounds like there were some behind the scenes stuff that Guillen had to manage. But you know, for that season, and then even for the couple of years after, just no signs of that whatsoever. Just coming out, throwing smoke, having a surprising complete array of secondary pitches where he didn't need to strike everybody out to be successful. And I think to me, the most impressive part of his debut season was the fact that he actually blew a save in the World Series. And, you know, that's something where, like, you know, maybe it goes wrong if he has that big high profile failure. And all of a sudden, you know, the White Sox are playing all these close games and he can't answer the bell. But like, he shook it off, ended up throwing two scoreless innings in the 13 inning game, and then, you know, saves the final out. So, yeah, really an amazing story. It's a shame that it happened to, you know, close so soon, both in terms of his career and then, you know, not, we're talking about his life now, because it did seem like he was evolving. It did seem like, you know, for as old as he was, or yeah, in terms of 44, you don't say, like, typically you don't wave away things of like, you know, oh, he's still evolving, he's still immature, he's still, like, given his background, given all the stuff he overcame, the fact that he still had growth in him, the fact that he was managing the Windy City Thunderbolts and taking it seriously, like, when I saw that, I thought, oh, he's collecting a check, and the Thunderbolts are happy to have the celebrity. This isn't going to be a, nobody's putting a whole lot of effort in this. No, apparently he was doing a great job of connecting, and then the Thunderbolts wanted him back and he wanted to be back. And just, I think it spoke to just how sincerely he took this project of trying to better himself after, you know, the many horrors that he encountered, both, you know, when it comes to surgery, addiction, you know, the turbulence of this family, etc. So yeah, it is a shame on multiple levels that it was cut short and he wasn't able to see this hard work through.
James, what was your favorite memories of Bobby Jenks?
To add on to Jim's point about, like, he merges like, you know, kind of in folk hero fashion, and like, oh, he got released from the Angels for being, you know, I was 18 at the time, so it seemed like adhering too much to the events of like Major League Two. And you're like, oh, this sounds like an exciting thing, and comes in and he's like this phenomenon of the season, but he actually turns out to be like pretty much an elite closer for multiple years, and someone who had a pretty prolonged peak that obviously could have continued into his 30s if not for kind of the really unfortunate medical issues he dealt with, and the, you know, malpractice case that, you know, wound up ending his career. So he kind of gets sold as this larger life personality, when like my brain kind of goes to, like, this dude was just like an elite relief arm by every standard of his era. So for me, it's, maybe this is on brand, but I feel like Bobby Jenks taught me about fastball carry at like an early teenage, because Hawk had, you know, every broadcast during that time, sinkers and two seamers were very prevalent, and you just, like, any guard variety color commentator you'd hear, and certainly Hawk would just be talking about, got to pitch down the zone, got to get ground balls and stuff like that, to see like them have to acknowledge, like, actually Bobby Jenks' stuff works best up in the zone. You actually see him, like, especially the blown save he had when his fastball got down, and they had to acknowledge, like, yeah, some guys who throw harder actually work up there, and it kind of gets your mind,
and probably tunneling too with this curve.
Right, exactly. He was a high four seamer curveball guy, like, in 2005 of all times, especially watching that staff just, like, you know, throw sinker after sinker en route to, like, you know, complete games where Bobby doesn't really pitch in the Angel series. But yeah, it was someone who kind of pitched in a way that became prevalent seemingly 10 years later, more than you even saw back then. So Bobby being kind of this early proto version of that, it was really interesting in my baseball understanding journey.
Yeah, Mark Burley's statue unveiling will be on Friday, July 11th. Many of the 2005 White Sox players will be returning that weekend to celebrate not only Burley, but the world championship as well. I'm sure on Monday nights against the Blue Jays, there will be a moment of silence from the Chicago White Sox in honoring Bobby Jenks. The Colorado Rockies made a very nice gesture over the weekend to pay homage to Bobby Jenks during the series against the White Sox. And I'm sure we'll hear more stories from his former teammates, but it's an unfortunate end to a cult hero of the 2005 World Series team. Moving forward, Shane Smith News for the White Sox. He is officially the White Sox All-Star. Jim, I know you wrote about this on SoxMachine.com that the White Sox are making it tough to find someone to represent them at the All-Star game. Shane Smith, 17 starts, 83 2/3 innings. He has a 4.20 ERA. He's 3-7 on the season. His WAR on Fangraphs prior to Sunday's start was 1.3. That's second in the American League for rookie pitchers. Let's start with the good for Shane Smith. This is a good story for him, being a rookie pitcher, a Rule 5 pick. We were in Dallas, and when the White Sox selected him, we kind of had to do a lot of research on who is Shane Smith. He had a big spring training, and he's had a good first half. He had a great start to the season in April and May. We'll get into if he's running out of gas in a moment. But from a White Sox perspective, the front office, the coaching staff, and even Shane Smith for himself, Jim, this is a great honor for everyone involved to get him to be able to pitch at this level to become an All-Star.
Yeah, it's, you know, not only was we didn't know a whole lot about Shane Smith, but also he was traded or he was signed or picked at the same time the White Sox traded Garrett Crochet. So we had a lot to think about at the time. And
Crochet also making the All-Star team.
Yes, indeed. So, yeah. it was quite an eventful 30 minutes for White Sox luminaries, apparently. The thing that jumped out to me when looking at Smith and comparing him to Adrian Hauser and trying to figure out, like, is the White Sox All-Star really going to be somebody they signed on May 20th, or is it going to be a full season guy? Is Smith, you know, holding on together? You know, he might not even pitch in the All-Star game. It might be a case where he makes the roster, but he gets a break and he might need it. But it's a cool story. Like, you know, the odds are, you know, incredible. James wrote about it in terms of, you know, the work that went into it and the fact that everything's kind of been out of order for him all year. So why wouldn't he make the All-Star game before we actually know whether he's any good for a full season? Like, sure, makes sense. The thing that jumped out to me was when writing about how Garrett Crochet and Eric Fetty gave the White Sox two deserving All-Stars. You know, Crochet made it, Fetty didn't, but had Crochet not made the leap he made, like, Fetty would have been a fine choice as well. And there's no point in having two White Sox on the All-Star team, given how poorly they're playing. I didn't consider him a snub, but had he made the team, like, sure, he was a top 10 American League starter. You know, may as well make the team. But it feels like the years were mismatched in that, like, the 2024 team should have had a Rule 5 pick or a May signing make the All-Star team on their behalf, because, like, yeah, this is how dire things have gotten to where a Rule 5 pick is the best he can offer. And then this year would be the one where, oh, here's a future. Here's a fixture. Here's a emerging star who's going to be the, you know, one of the pillars of the next competitive White Sox team. Instead, it's backwards, and Smith is just this guy who, you know, is a courtesy pick for a team that's playing better than, you know, maybe needing a courtesy pick. Like, in terms of run differential, they're not anywhere close to the worst team in baseball. They're like an ordinary bad team. Just they're getting a lot of average to below average performances, whereas last year they had two star performances and then a whole bunch of dreck. So yeah, it's a little mismatched. You know, my guess is that he probably doesn't appear in the game just because, you know, not every pitcher does. And he might, you know, given his form, given how much he's struggling, given how little league knows about him, perhaps, like, the manager says, enjoy the trip, enjoy the jersey, and then we'll go get him in the second half. That would be my guess. But yeah, it is cool for him. It's just a shame that a little bit out of order to, you know, even if, you know, his ERA is like mid threes, that would be a pretty cool story. Whereas now it seems like he's got to get right and he's in the All-Star game. Does he actually want to make the trip, or does he want to just kind of rest up? It's of course he wants to make the trip, but yeah, it's an interesting juncture, and it feels like a little bit, everybody kind of feels like a little bit shortchanged in that this should be a cooler story. And yet, because of his All-Star birth, you have to examine it a little bit closer than you might have just, not looking a gift horse in the mouth and saying, like, hey, it's a Rule 5 pick who's still, faring well on the season.
Dan Uggla was the other one, right? Dan Uggla was the first Rule 5 mm-hmm. selection to make the All-Star game. Shane Smith is the second. So let's talk about the worrisome In his last seven starts, Shane Smith has a 7.42 ERA. That's over 30 and a third innings, so he's not even averaging five innings per start in his last seven. 27 strikeouts, 19 walks. So that strikeout to walk ratio is definitely shrinking. The last time Shane Smith pitched more than five innings, June 10th against the Houston Astros. Last year, and I think this is what's key, Smith pitched 94 and a third innings. That was a career high, no matter what level, college, minor leagues. That's the most innings that Shane Smith has ever pitched. He faced 382 batters last year. Again, entering the All-Star break, and he's got one more start before the All-Star break. Smith's already at 83 and two thirds innings, and he's already faced 346 batters. James, with Smith's recent struggles, is this just a pitcher exhausted right now? Is he just running out of gas because he's going to be approaching a career high in innings pitched? And the second part, the White Sox did this last year with Garrett Crochet. Could we see them start manipulating the innings for Shane Smith where he has shorter outings?
They don't seem to be inclined to say that he's wearing down. He's still throwing hard. His velo is up over a season average today. He doesn't profess to be tired. He doesn't. Ethan Katz didn't like point to it as a fatigue. He was up. Smith was himself was upbeat after his start post game, you know, talking with Lamont Pope and who was out there in Colorado. He's clearly off right now. But there's not some traditional measure of fatigue that they're pointing to, like, oh, they are going to continue to like give him extra rest, but that's kind of more built into how they approached and saw his innings anyway. Like, I don't think it would be quite, I mean, they've at least haven't indicated that they're going to go the Crochet route now. That was seen as more creativity in that situation. It, you know, obviously Crochet's could speak up for himself about par as like what the plan was going to be in that instance, maybe in a different way than would be present here. So I don't think he's going to blast beyond like, you know, 130, 140 innings or anything like that. And certainly if he does get fatigued, they'll probably act on it pretty quickly, but they're not currently pointing and screaming about that in some big way. Like Shane Smith himself said, like, if you see my like slider getting into the 90s, that means it's becoming a cutter and that's bad. And he threw plenty of 91 mile an hour sliders today. So that's something that's like clearly not operating as it should be. Is his changeup, he's not really commanding it the way he needs to. You saw someone like ending up way glove side, which is pretty much never where he's trying to throw it, and it hasn't been getting the whiffs you would want. So that's something that hasn't seemed like as good as it's been earlier in the season. Barely used his curveball today. Like, it's just very fastball heavy, and they like his fastball. Like, they think it plays better than, you know, what its IVP would say it would be. But he whether or not he's clearly off in some way, like anyone could look at the box score and see that, but like his stuff has not been executed greatly. But they're not pointing to fatigue as it, because he's not claiming to be. And I guess they don't have any biomechanical alarms going off right now. So, or at least not any of them talking about publicly in some big way to explain what's going on. So hopefully he just starts pitching better, because as far as I can tell, that's what the main plan is. As far as at least responding to what's going on now, it's not, I think you're going to see any restrictions, but I don't know if it'd be fair to call them responsive to the results.
Got it. Okay. No, that makes sense. So his stuff just needs to be better. So again, the slider, to your point, look at the miles per hour. If it's going too fast, it's a cutter.
It's not waning. It's like flattening out.
Yeah. Got it. Needs more break. Changeup needs to be better. Well, hopefully he can bounce
it's
back.
It's like reverse speed.
Yeah, it sure is. Need to slow down. Need to slow down. But still, I mean, in April and May, Shane Smith was excellent. Even in June, he had back-to-back great starts against the Detroit Tigers and the Houston Astros. So the talent is legit. I mean, look how well Detroit and Houston have been playing. After the White Sox got swept by the Dodgers, Houston went into L.A. and embarrassed the Dodgers in Los Angeles, and Smith did more than hold his own against both of those quality teams. So he's got quality stuff, and he's demonstrated in the first half to earn the honor to be the White Sox All-Star. But hopefully he gets past whatever's been ailing him in his last seven starts and gets back on track and helping the White Sox start winning more games. A Sox Machine public service announcement. We have brand new items in the Sox Machine store. With the weather heating up, we've got new Adidas Sox Machine polos, perfect for your company outings, casual Fridays, and of course the golf course. It's part of our media attire as well when covering events. You can grab any of these three styles that we now have in the store. We've got new Sox Machine coffee mugs to sip from while you read Jim and James in the morning, new stainless steel water bottles with the Sox Machine logo, and fanny packs, which fanny packs have been very helpful entering Major League Baseball stadiums with all the bag restrictions. Visit shop.soxmachine.com to check out the new gear. And for Sox Machine subscribers, remember your discount code to get an additional discount when checking out. Again, the URL is shop.soxmachine.com. The White Sox did win the series against the Colorado Rockies this past weekend. They won Friday 3-2. Saturday won big time 10-3. On Sunday, they had a 4-2 lead, but they squandered it and ended up losing 6-4. But what this series really is the MLB debut of Colson Montgomery. And he made a good first impression in these three games. Montgomery went 5-for-10. He hit a triple, drove in two RBIs, walked twice. He did strike out twice. His first plate appearance resulted in reaching on catcher's interference, which is very rare for a debut at bats. Friday, defensively, he made an awesome over-the-shoulder catch to save a run. On Sunday, with a runner on third and fewer than, I think there's just no outs. Yeah, there's a runner on third, nobody out. Back-to-back plays hit directly at Montgomery with the infield in, and in both plays, he prevented a run. And the second time, he threw the runner out at home plate. So defensively, Montgomery looked good. Offensively, Montgomery looked good in the second and third games. Jim, what are your first impressions of Colson Montgomery in the majors?
So far, none of the alarm signs from his Charlotte days have shown. Like, there haven't been any whiffs on high fastballs. Did a pretty good job of laying off junk below the zone. Breaking balls, either fighting him off or laying him off. If he did swing over one, he didn't swing over it twice, which I think, you know, it's always fine if somebody chases once, but it's when, you know, like the Lenin Sosa thing or the Brooks Baldwin thing with high fastballs. Like, if they keep doing it, that's where the problem lies. And, you know, had he not been a rookie who had been through hell and high water this year, like, you know, you would have had just an ordinary good series. I will say that, you know, the debuting in Colorado, while not maybe great for ticket sales or like, you know, building excitement for a homestand, and perhaps they don't need any with the homestand activities this coming weekend to where they don't need to sell tickets. But just the fact that, like, it's Colorado, it's a good place to hit, forgiving place to hit. The pitching staff they're facing, not good. A nice introduction. I think the fact that Brooks Baldwin also had a good series, I view him a little bit. Maybe not perfect doubles or like one's an indicator for the other, but the fact that like they couldn't execute high fastballs on Baldwin, they tried and, you know, they couldn't locate him that well. Like, got a couple chases, got a couple strikeouts, but he also was able to take advantage of misses in the zone. Same thing with like, you know, Baldwin hitting Dustin May out. Same thing, like try to sinker high, couldn't get it there, and Baldwin made him pay, but couldn't do it. They seemed like they couldn't do it against Montgomery or didn't have like the arsenal to do it. So they just stuck with breaking balls down and didn't work. But yeah, I can see tougher assignments coming when you get back to sea level, basically, and you face teams that are not the worst team in baseball. But I think given what he faced, given the array of ways he was tested in the field, he passed. I think, yeah, he just had the rookie mistake of the pickoff, which actually turned out to be pretty important, that he got caught off first base, kind of blew up a golden scoring opportunity, and then they didn't score again. That's something you can take away from the series, is a little bit of a welcome to the big leagues moment. But everything else, like, yeah, he fared about as well as you could reasonably expect him to fare.
James, what were your first impressions of Colson Montgomery in the majors?
He looks all right. I don't think they pitched him well. I thought he did a good job. Like, especially his walk on Sunday was good as far as like laying off, back foot breaker. And that was a pretty well located one. And there wasn't as much up in the zone whiff as I would have been concerned about, just with him facing major league heaters for the first time. I don't know why you like pitch him outer half at this point in his career, and I would assume the Rockies mostly did it unintentionally. It was good that he got a lot of hits out of it. We didn't quite see him like explode into one, but it was like in his first three games. You definitely saw him kind of muscle the ball out of the infield on like an end of the barrel contact a few times, so that's nice. And I thought he was pretty good defensively. Especially you can kind of see how his arm allows him to play balls differently from even just someone like Chase Mydroff. Like he can sit back in situations a lot more, and he can kind of load up and make up time with I think a pretty above average throwing arm yet. There was points where like Lenin Sosa made like a really like slick flip to him that he turned on the cannon to like turn a double play to get out of like one of the 1500 jams on Saturday. Just like I can't imagine, I never saw this double play combination happening at all, let alone like looking fluid together. What a time, what strange bedfellows. So I don't like every flaw we've ever been worried about has been solved by this three game Rocky series, but I also don't think he did anything discouraging during it for three games. Other than getting picked off, but like that you'd almost have to like get picked off repeatedly before it's like, what's wrong with this guy? It's more something that happened to him. So A plus, as far as first impressions, I don't think we have gotten to the choppy parts of the waters yet, but there was certainly nothing to other than positives to kind of see what he did. I'm trying to be upbeat more often in life, and Colson Montgomery didn't give me reason to shake out of it.
Oh, that's good. That's good to hear. Yeah, good first impression by Colson Montgomery. We'll see how he does against the Toronto Blue Jays. We'll preview that series in a moment here. Other West Coast road trip notables. Jim mentioned Brooks Baldwin. Baldwin had a good road trip, 6 for 17 with two doubles and a home run. Edgar Caro hit his first home run. Kyle Teal still shut out in that category. Jim, are you surprised that Edgar Caro hit a home run before Kyle Teal?
I guess given, I would say no, given the chances, just, Caro's had more plate appearances. But in the fact that, it happened while Teal's on the roster and they had a comparable amount of run while, teammates a little, it did remind me a little bit of watching Caro hit his first homer in Birmingham a couple of years ago, and him saying like, "Wasn't sure I got all of it." And he said, talked about how he was running down the first base line, basically saying "Go ball, go" as he was following it, and had the same kind of track. And of course, like it didn't look explosive off the bat, and the outfielder kept drifting, and I think he was running pretty hard. So yeah, I don't know if he got to savor it the way that he might have hoped his first homer would work, but it was very good silent treatment on the back end of that. Like we hadn't seen that in a while with the White Sox, probably because they don't have, or they haven't had at times, the veteran presence, I think, to pull off the silent treatment. Everybody's kind of in the same boat of being happy to be there and
Yeah.
unproven. So in this case, it is nice that they are able to give a rookie a no reaction whatsoever in the dugout for 15 seconds, because I think that's a sign that there are some signs of accomplishment in the dugout.
Yeah, Mike Talkman led the charge in that silent treatment. Talkman went 8 for 25 on this road trip. He made a great home run robbing catch against the Dodgers earlier in the week. Lenin Sosa, 6 for 20, two doubles, a home run, and he drove in five RBIs. And then eventually we may see this from Colson Montgomery, but on the young players going through a cold streak, Miguel Vargas and Chase Mydroth right now are cold at the plate. Vargas is 2 for his last 20. Mydroth is 2 for his last 19. But the White Sox got the 30 wins before the All-Star break. They just need to win 12 more games to win more than last year. That's all we're asking for. It's mid-July, and they have a chance to add more wins before the All-Star break, as they are now home for the next 7 games against the Toronto Blue Jays and the Cleveland Guardians. The first three games are against the Blue Jays Monday through Wednesday. The Toronto Blue Jays are in first place in the American League East, and not only are they in first place in the American League East, they're now 3 games ahead of the New York Yankees and the Tampa Bay Rays. They're 52 and 38. They have won their last 8 games. They are 9-1 in their last 10. On the road, though, they are still struggling. They are 20-22 this year. The season series, the White Sox again won the series in Toronto. So the White Sox are up 2-1 on the Blue Jays. Offensively, again, like we talked about a couple podcast episodes ago when previewing the White Sox and Blue Jays, the Blue Jays offense is night and day when they are at home and when they are on the road. Offensively this year, runs per game, the Blue Jays are averaging 4.58 runs. On the road, they're averaging 3.74. Their team OPS in the season is 731. At home, it's 796. That's the second best in Major League Baseball. On the road, it's 660. And for pitching-wise, the starters this year, 4.63 staff ERA. That's bottom five at Major League Baseball. The bullpen, though, is top 10 at 3.62. On the road, they do pitch a little better. They are 4.28 as a staff ERA. Your pitching problems for this series, Monday night, July 7th. The first pitch is going to be at 6:40 p.m. Central Time. Jose Barrios, who pitched very well against the White Sox in his last start, against Sean Burke. Tuesday, July 8th, 6:40 p.m. Central Time, Chris Bassitt against Aaron Civale. And then Wednesday, getaway day for the Blue Jays. It's a 1:10 p.m. Central Time start. Lefty Eric Lauer for the Blue Jays against Adrian Hauser, which Hauser will be making his final start prior to the All-Star break. And I don't know, we're at this stage of Hug Watch. Could this be Hauser's last start with the White Sox? We'll see. But for this season preview, I have to eat a little crow because at our first half episode recap, we were buying and selling teams in Major League Baseball. And I was buying the Tampa Bay Rays. And damn it, to say that the Rays have caught the Yankees, I feel good about myself. But man, I was selling the Blue Jays, and here they are leading the American League East as they come back to Chicago. And Jim, George Springer, in his last 13 games, has 6 home runs and 21 RBIs. That is the production from Michael A. Taylor in 77 games this season, and Springer has an OPS over 1,300. I'm still confused on how the Blue Jays are doing this, but it just seems weird at game 90. Here are the Blue Jays coming to Chicago, and they're first place in the American League East. Are you buying them?
Well, it's funny. They've won 5 out of the last 6 series, and the one series that they lost was to the White Sox. So perhaps it was like perfectly timed. The classic trap series that John Triffin kept saying the White Sox were considering the Rockies to be, even though they're basically in the same boat. But it's I'm happy for Springer personally, because when the White Sox were pretending to spend money and then not doing it, like the price kept coming down. Like Springer was after the Bryce Harper one. It's like, well, here's a right fielder who's perfect for what you need and also costs half the commitment in terms of years and dollars. If you didn't want to go 13 years for Bryce Harper and over $300 million, how about Springer for 6 and 150? And it probably doesn't even have to be 150, because it sounded like the Blue Jays had to pay a Toronto tax for getting him to go to Canada. So maybe like 6 for 140. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, he has his, you know, classic, mix of injuries and, you know, some just poor performances. And you think like, oh, the White Sox dodged a bullet. And then here he is, resurgent, looking like the guy I want him to sign. So I like being personally validated by, the White Sox ducking free agents. And I thought he was a missed opportunity given how little they wanted to spend and just, you know, how the market kept bending to them and them saying like, now we're good. And then it turns out they weren't good, but cool for him. When it comes to the Blue Jays overall, I am enjoying the little pissing match that they're getting into with the Yankees. Like I think they've gotten under the Yankee skin with, how well they're doing despite, not the most exciting offseason. And I think the Blue Jays front office is designed to disappoint a little bit, the way Mark Shapiro kind of just conducts himself and does not really energize the fan base with his words or actions. It's all about like, more bottom line stuff or arbitrage and not really, I guess the Vlad Guerrero signing was a little bit of a departure, but also that was kind of painstakingly done to where I felt like they had to do it to prove themselves. But, I think it's driving Michael Kay nuts a little bit in New York, and that's fun.
What doesn't drive Michael Kay nuts?
Yeah. he doesn't take jokes well. He's very thin skinned, but it's fun. Like, I enjoy them being in this role of disruptor. You know, the Rays are a disruptor in a way, but I think the Jays are, you know, they have more resources to do it. They can sign or trade for more accomplished players, and so it's a different kind of disruption. It feels more ambitious than what the Rays do, and it's cool to see it work.
Are you buying the Blue Jays, James Fegan?
For playoffs, sure. I think this seems like their high point. The best they're playing all season, and the worst the Yankees are playing all season. And unless they become newly aggressive at the deadline, you wonder about them holding off the Yankees. So, I mean, my cousin is the most doomerous Yankees fan I know, and he was complaining about their lack of pitching before they lost Clark Schmidt. So maybe they are just really screwed this time. But I do think we're seeing kind of like a cresting for the Jays, a bit beyond like what they can maybe sustain play level rise for the whole year. But they've also obviously put themselves in a nice spot where I think they'll hold on to a wild card spot. Didn't love their system in a way that I feel like they have a ton of ammunition for the deadline, but and certainly losing like Jake Bloss earlier in the season hurts as far as like their reinforcements or trade chips they'd have. So yeah, I think they should be taken seriously as a wild card contender. Aston Barter has been great, but as far as like this is the new power in the AL East, I don't know. I watched them lose 2 out of 3 to the White Sox, so that proves it.
Back over to the White Sox perspective, James, we've been getting more social media hits. Our friend Jimmy Pardo on Blue Sky tagged Jim and I in a, do we know what we're calling, Blue Sky Post? We'll just call him Blue Sky Post at this moment, asking, why is Josh Rojas still on the team? And I know you wrote this great feature story about Josh Rojas, and he seems very cerebral. He understands why he is struggling. He is still struggling. Is there anyone in the minors to challenge Josh Rojas? Like, is Josh Rojas in the danger zone? If he doesn't have a good week, are we talking about DFA territory pretty soon?
I mean, I'd flip it and like, why do fans like get so like animated about the 26 man on the roster losing their job? Like, I feel like if a team's like cut the worst player on their position player on their team like once a week, like they could keep their fans decently happy for a while because it'd be like some notion of accountability. It's probably the same situation I would say for Vinny Capra, where it's like, who do you want to now insert into this doesn't play that much role? I think the argument could be like playing Rojas less, because you have Sosa hitting well, you have Montgomery, you have Mydroth, you have like all these three compelling options to do in the infield. Vargas is pretty much every day. So anytime you rotate him off of first, you probably think that'd be felt by Rojas. But I don't like, is there a big urge for someone that you really are excited about, like a future fifth infielder that you'll feel like they're developing because they're getting Josh Rojas's at bats as opposed to someone else? Sure, he's got like a 500 OPS. He could be DFA'd at any time, and I don't think anyone would be stunned. They might move him to some team for cash considerations on the premise of, hey, do you want your own backup infielder who barely plays? Here's one who could do it. We'll eat some of the money, even sort of thing. Like, so there's worth to keeping him through the deadline. I just think like it's not like they're not playing Colson over him, or even not playing like Mydroth regularly over him. I think Lenin bashes his way in the playing time or oops his way out of it on its natural cycle, and it's not like really affected by other earthly influences. So I think if he's effectively demoted on the infielder tier ranking and Vinny Capra got squeezed off the bottom of it, I think what mainly people are objecting, like Rojas playing so much, should theoretically disappear because like he's received an in-kind demotion in terms of like playing time. But if it's really just like whenever I see the 26th man on my team that isn't good, I think about how not good he is and I demand change, then I don't know. Maybe that could happen. But like, are you do you want Jacob Maya back? Like, what are you campaigning for? Like, is this like the dog that caught the car situation as far as like replacing your fifth infielder? Like, feel like you're on the bus at the end of the graduate with, you know, Tristan Gray, and you don't know why you're here. Like, so that's why I think he's on the team to answer the question, if that did.
And I think, like, you mentioned Mydroth struggling, Vargas struggling. Like, there are guys who are who need the breather. So I think ideally there would probably be a point where Rojas gets the Vinny Capra treatment of just playing once a week and nobody feels bad about it. And Montgomery's playing every day and Vargas is bouncing between the corners every day. You still have the question of like why Ryan Nota is getting the run that he's getting. Just yeah, you understand why Rojas is playing because the White Sox signed him. They made a point of going out and getting him, and they feel like he had certain things like the Nota coming over from a waiver claim and then just kind of getting a lot of playing time despite doing nothing. That's the one that's more confusing to me. But I think should Vargas get back on track, should Mydroth, and I think Mydroth will go through these ruts of because he doesn't make loud contact and because he doesn't get like bases in bulk. Like I think he's going to have these cold spells and kind of buoys the value with walks and still getting on base. But sometimes the singles won't drop for him. Like I can imagine him getting back on track. And at that point you'll have four guys you like playing well enough and Rojas will take a back seat. But I think while Vargas is in this rut that I think it's been like, at least a solid 2 weeks for him. That's, if breathers have to happen, then Rojas is the guy who bounces in between third and second, and other guys play first, and he appears and tries not to get in the way.
I think, like, I suppose, like, there's the always argument of, like, well, if one of these guys is just going to be not major league caliber in their performance, why not just have Elko come do it? And at least we'll find out something. At this point, like, I think the argument would probably be more Elko for Nota, because, like, if you bring up Elko to force Vargas back to third, and you're because you're kicking out Rojas, because that's the end goal to start, then you are kind of putting Mydroth and Sosa and Montgomery in competition for playing each other. Maybe you don't sweat that so much. Maybe you get really mad. I don't know. But I wouldn't see, like, then you'd be like, well, why is Nota here? So I think, and fundamentally, the choice between like carrying a platoon of two first basemen or having a guy who's not hitting at all, but like they feel fine slapping him anywhere defensively and they feel like he generally adheres to the standard of defensive execution they're trying to do. This is the front office that's made the latter choice rather than like, we're going to cycle through all these options looking for offensive production, hell or high water. The way that you could see the last front office maybe spinning their wheels on, jamming misfit bats into weird places. And then like all of a sudden they're underperforming on both sides of the ball for some reason. It feels like maybe they're reacting to that with being more defensive oriented, and thus signing players like Rojas in the first place and then committing to him for a little bit longer than, it seems like certain very respected, please still keeps listening to us, members of our audience can tolerate.
Hey, Ryan Nota is on the team because he could play right field, Jim. We can't forget
Oh,
about
yeah.
that.
Yeah,
No,
who would?
notable right fielder.
I think this is maybe also where you feel kind of the absence of an emergent Brian Ramos. Like it seems like he's kind of hit a wall in AAA, not being able to hit righties. And so he's just,
I think
right now he looks
that's a good point that you
at best
make,
like a
Jim.
platoon bat. So, yeah.
Because our previous conversation, like Vinny Capra, right? When we were talking about Colson Montgomery possibly being called up because he had five good games against Toledo, that conversation was Vinny Capra is bad and you could easily replace him. His final at bat with the White Sox is Clayton Kershaw's 3,000 strikeouts. So, what a great send off that is.
And Colton's
Josh.
file about bat with the Knights was having Corey Jolks intentionally walk in front of him. So who knows how good
Who
he's going to be.
knows? Tim Elko replaced Andrew Vaughn because Andrew Vaughn was giving nothing to the White Sox at first base. And it just seems like, all right, here's another prime opportunity. Like the point that you're making, like I totally agree with you. And that's a really good point, Jim. Like here's a prime opportunity. this time nobody's there. Like Montgomery was there, Elko was there. Now there's nobody for the White Sox to take advantage of this.
Tristan Gray, I guess, is, you know, the guy who's now in that Vinny Capra role of just, we need somebody to play short and second and third in a pinch, and we don't want to call Jacob Amaya for the third time on a roster. So we like the cut of Gray's jib, and he'll be around, but it seems like he's now the emergency in-house option for those positions. He could be usurped by a waiver claim. It seems like the way the White Sox are rolling this year, and that if somebody on the outside interests them more, they have no problem of putting them ahead in the queue. But I think for now, the infield's mostly settled until Rojas is traded, and then maybe you see that first base come back into play with Elko coming back and giving like one last good look at his hit tool or something like that. But yeah, that's further down the road.
Rojas this year, what's really surprising, according to Fangraphs, -4 defensive run saved at third base. He was +7 last year for the Seattle Mariners, one of the top defensive third basemen in Major League Baseball. -4.
Seems like it's smoothing out a little bit, although he had that hard luck error. Coors Field, real bad design flaw with the way the sun goes down behind the left field corner in a way that blinds first baseman and everybody who's sitting behind them. Like the first time I went to Coors Field and bought tickets by myself, I was like, wow, these tickets are cheap. We're like right behind first base or like a couple sections behind you, 15th row, $20. Like, sure, I'll take that. And then I couldn't see for the first three innings. Felt like every, then that was before the netting down the line. So it felt like every screamer line drive could just cave my face in because couldn't track it whatsoever. So the fact that, you know, he tried to keep the throw low for Vargas and Vargas still couldn't find it hurts his ratings, I think, a little bit. But I think he's been smoothing out there. But yeah, certainly a terrible introduction to third base, and I think he's still digging out of that hole.
Yeah, again, just it's disappointing that nobody else is there for Charlotte that could step up and take these plate appearances for the rest of the season. So to James's point, Rojas is your 26th man on the team right now. He's that veteran leader that Will Venable will be talking about. Need those guys in the clubhouse with so many young players, but hopefully his playing time diminishes and the White Sox divvy out more playing time and to the young players, because again, there's still a lot of questions that need answers for the White Sox post All-Star break.
If Ramos just like nukes a AAA team for like a whole series, I think there's precedent there.
That is a good point, James. There is precedent. So just needs 5 good games, and then it's Brian Ramos time again at third.
Like 8
base.
Homers, something like that. Nothing crazy.
Go play Toledo again. So that's the White Sox. And again, we'll be recapping the Blue Jays series Wednesday night in our upcoming podcast episode. And if you haven't gotten a chance, you can listen to the previous episode over the 4th of July weekend. I sat down with MLB.com's Jim Callis to preview next week's MLB draft and who could go number one and the White Sox watch board. But kind of shocking news, though, around Major League Baseball. And we start with this headline. The Washington Nationals fired general manager Mike Rizzo and manager Dave Martinez on Sunday night, first reported by ESPN's Jeff Passan. USA Today's Bob Nightingale tweeted out an interesting nugget of information that both Rizzo and Martinez, their contracts were set to expire mid-July of the 2026 season, which is really odd. So from a Nationals management perspective, they are letting go their GM and their manager with a year left to go on their contract. So that would have been really weird if they both stayed on going to 2026, at least to start the season, knowing their contracts are set to expire halfway through. But what makes this dramatic and incredibly interesting? The Washington Nationals have the first pick in the 2025 Major League Baseball draft. And Jim, an interim GM, is now going to be making that pick for the Nationals. I don't know what direction they go now, because all the information has been scouts from the Nationals and that decision making being driven by Mike Rizzo, who's been part of the franchise for a long time. Now they could go completely in a different direction because here's a new interim GM, and who knows what direction they'll be taking the team depending on what his bosses, the owners of the Nationals, want him to do.
Yeah, you could see it going a couple ways in that, you know, with the first pick, it's a case of maybe we don't want Rizzo overruling a voice they trust more, be a scouting director. Maybe they do think the interim GM has a better finger on the pulse of things, or is less desperate to like have a job saving type pick. And so there'll be a lot more harmony going into the pick, or maybe the owners will bigfoot whoever's there and be like, no, we want this. This is going to be the poster child for a team the way Bryce Harper was, or the way Steven Strasburg was. And so we want to make this pick. And so we just get Rizzo out of the way and make it happen ourselves. So I think it makes sense, even though, as weird as the timing is right before the draft to go, I guess, cut off the head of your organization. It's certainly makes more sense than having somebody you don't trust making that pick. Kind of like the way we talked about with the White Sox and the trade deadline, having Rick Hahn and Kenny Williams there, while they're trying to undo all the damage that had occurred a couple years ago, and given the trade deadline to do it and given the draft to do it, and then getting fired in August after all those important decisions were made, and you had the Jacob Gonzalez thing, which felt like one of the canaries in the coal mine for a lack of consensus in the front office, and the way that the decision-making chain could get so easily tangled. But it's certainly a different approach, and it's fascinating. Like, it's good palace intrigue, high drama. It seems like there has been for a while when it comes to Rizzo. Like, he's had some contentious negotiations publicly, and kind of a will they, won't they. And the fact that his contract went through mid-July is weird, but also kind of makes sense. Like, guys who are lame ducks in that position, typically, if they're going to be fired, they tend to get fired. If they tend to be extended, they tend to get extended early. They don't tend to go into that last year without a contract. So I guess it makes sense. It's like it's a lack of eyewash to give them a full year, and makes the stakes very clear. But fascinated to see where they go because, Rizzo's been there for a very long time.
The Nationals are last place in the National League East. They're 37-53. Again, if you listen to the previous podcast episode with Jim Callis is thinking then the Nationals would go either LSU left-handed pitcher Cade Anderson or prep shortstop Ethan Holliday, the younger brother of Jackson Holliday of the Baltimore Orioles, and of course the son of former All-Star Matt Holliday. We'll see now. I don't know. I don't know. Maybe it doesn't really change anything as far as the draft process because you're a week away. But again, if it's not known, or Rizzo was hoping to go in one direction and now Mike DiBartolo, who's the interim GM, steps in and now they're going in a different direction, I'm expecting more gossip and rumors to be coming later down this week. James, I'll start with you. What is catching your attention around Major League Baseball?
I am just constantly seeking out my old friends. Andrew Vaughn's getting called up for the Brewers. It's pretty clearly a needs-based promotion because Rhys Hoskins just has a thumb sprain injury of some kind. Vaughn has been better with Milwaukee's like AAA affiliates. I want to say like a 122 WRC plus because he's hit three homers in 15 games. He has a 58% ground ball rate down there. So rolling over a lot. Seems like maybe whatever they're doing with him is more in progress than complete, but we'll see how it goes. And Eric Fetty didn't make it out of the second inning for the Cardinals tonight, Thunder Night Baseball. Against the Cubs, he had a kind of blow up outing right before that. Ali Marmol was not super committed to him post game. They said like you're gonna do a step back and see where he's at. Feels like they probably just saw where he's at a little bit. He seemed in good spirits when I spoke to him when he was we had a little pregame notes interview with him a couple days back when the St. Louis Cardinals were in town. But it's been a little bit of a step down. Certainly last year, like he was still fine after the trade, but didn't like take a next level of it. And some of the peripherals kind of took a little bit of a nudge back, even if he was still a sub four ERA guy and plenty useful. Seemed like he pitched a complete game this season, at one point, but obviously is struggling right now for a team that isn't really in the position to suffer through somebody figuring it out in the way that Fetty obviously would have had rope to do here. Interesting to see how it goes, but the White Sox kind of always felt like they couldn't. They felt like at least their contention post trade after hearing all of us criticize how little they got. Talking to them, they're like other teams were not as sold on Fetty being like a frontline all fringe all-star guy the way that we thought he had shown himself to be. So maybe that means they're right. That's why the White Sox got whatever they got. Or maybe hopefully Fetty being a great guy who's great to deal with. Hopefully rights the ship and looks more like the guy from 2024 first half, where multiple White Sox decision makers argued that I should write something saying how all-star worthy he is because he had a winning record on such a bad team. And I was like, I get it, but why are you the ones making this case to me? Very strange. Anyway, that's what I noticed from around the league.
I'm sensing this offseason, James might be advocating the White Sox to bring back Eric Fetty to help out with the starting rotation.
Bring back literally just everyone I ever enjoyed in any capacity. Bring back Jose Quintana, mostly enjoyed watching him. James McCann seems like a great veteran to have back up your two elite catchers for some reason. Poor roster construction, but I wouldn't hate it. Spend all like money you don't have on Lucas Giolito for some reason. I don't know. He's ready to come back.
He's been pitching great for Boston.
Yeah, I don't
He's
understand
on a
why
hot
he'd come
streak.
back here, not why they would sign him.
I thought he loved it here.
But like, I think
what, does
he
want
wants
to
win.
Win?
Yeah, like that. Or like he paid market
you
value.
Idiot.
Like the reasons like that. It never seemed like he would sign a second deal here. Like all his like understanding how the business works and like how much like a win is on the market. Like he has all these weird concepts that are floating around his big brain.
People with standards.
Boo.
Shake my head. Jim, how about you? What's catching your attention around Major League Baseball?
The Guardians have lost 10 in a row. Looking at their last 30 games, 69 runs, or 30 days, so 26 games, 69 runs. White Sox have played 26 games. They've scored 87. So the White Sox are a standard deviation better when it comes to offense. Bottom three offenses in baseball, all in the AL Central. White Sox, then the Royals, and the Guardians, 28th, 29th, and 30th. So to Chris Getz's point that the Central is forgiving and that there's a pathway to contention that isn't there in other divisions, perhaps we wrote off that line of reasoning too soon. But it really seems like when you look at that line, like Jose Ramirez is still pretty good. Stephen Kwan is still Stephen Kwan, and like just nothing behind it. Yeah, Kyle Manzardo's been okay, but like, think they took Josh Naylor for granted a little bit, and that like the while his production may have been kind of uneven or defensively not great, like I think he gave that lineup something that it cannot easily replicate. Like the problems filling out the outfield and getting a first baseman, Carlos Santana hasn't been the option. Like it really seems like their magic has worn out a little bit with the formula that they've used so successfully for like 25 years. So interesting to see where they go from here. I think the Royals, their situation is more clear. Like they were maybe a bit early in breaking out and they had some young performances to understand and trying to supplement the roster, and their outfield looked a little bit sketchy before the season. That's borne out. But still, like their stars are their stars. They've had some pitching injuries that they couldn't afford or couldn't absorb, and now they're really struggling. But seems like their path is still pretty clear. Just depends on what kind of rope their leadership has, or maybe their manager has. But I think with the Guardians, like it does seem like it's a very much a direct hit to their template that they've used, and so curious where they go, curious how they adjust, because like this offense has been a problem for a long time, or at least around the non Ramirez and Kwan components, and just they really have a hell of a time trying to find anybody else who can hit.
Think of what a story will be that Shane Smith, the Rule 5 pick, who throws a perfect game right before his first All-Star game. People will wonder why he's not starting in the game.
Or the Guardians explode for 12 runs and like he goes in the All-Star game being like, oh, his ERA is 4.83 and he's your All-Star. Move over, Mike Williams.
Yeah, he's going to the All-Star game, but after that he's going to the complex in Arizona to figure things out.
That'd be very White Sox. The Minnesota Twins are currently second place in the American League Central with a 43-47 record. They are 13.5 games back of Detroit. The White Sox, last place, 30-60, are 13 games back of the Minnesota Twins. The second place Minnesota Twins are closer to the last place Chicago White Sox than they are to Detroit right now in the standings. Detroit already has a 13.5 game lead. They might win this division easily by 15 games. Is 20 games within reach? I have to look back to see when was the last time someone won the Central by 20 games. It feels more recent. But when you look at the American League postseason outlook a week before the All-Star break, only 7 teams in the American League have a winning record. Only 7. So the Boston Red Sox at 46-45 are the team that's got that 7th standing right now. They're 2.5 games back of the wild card, but if the season were to end today in the American League, Detroit would have the number 1 seed, Houston the number 2 seed. It would be the Toronto Blue Jays against the 6th seed Seattle Mariners, and the New York Yankees the 4th seed against the 5th seed Tampa Bay Rays, which if the Rays even hosted that game, it'd be at the Yankee Spring Training Complex. So the American League, we knew this was going to be weird. We knew it was going to be wacky. Was it going to be as good as the National League? And they are living up to the billing, especially in the pre-All-Star break. But yeah, that's what's going around Major League Baseball. Let us know what you guys are paying attention to around Major League Baseball in the comments section, or hit us up on social media. But that will do it for this episode of the Sox Machine Podcast. Thank you guys so much for listening. If you just discovered the Sox Machine Podcast, you can subscribe to the show wherever you listen to podcasts such as Spotify and Apple Music. You can also check out our videos. I posted a new video on our YouTube channel at youtube.com with Jim Callis as we go through our watch board as far as 4 prospects that we are targeting for the White Sox to take 10th overall in next week's MLB draft. Also promotion, I'll be hosting a watch party online of the MLB draft that you could join me on playback.tv. We'll watch the MLB draft and I'll be breaking down the picks as they come through. I'm really curious to see what happens at number 1. The Angels could surprise us at pick number 2. There could be a lot of shuffling. We could all be wrong with their mock drafts, but it'll be a lot of fun to watch regardless. And we have a lot more MLB draft content coming to your guys' way this week to prepare for who the White Sox could possibly take of the 1st, 2nd, and even 3rd round on the opening day of the MLB draft. So pretty excited about that. Again, subscribe to your YouTube channel at youtube.com/SoxMachine. Follow us on social media. We're on all the platforms at Sox Machine. The White Sox being at home means that James is back to work at the stadium. Follow him on social media at JR Fegan for the latest news coming out of the White Sox clubhouse. You can follow me at SoxMachine_Josh. We are on Blue Sky. You can follow us at SoxMachine.com. Follow James at JRFegan.SoxMachine.com. You can follow me, Josh.SoxMachine.com. If you want full access to all of our coverage of the Chicago White Sox, Major League Baseball, and the MLB draft, you can get that by becoming a subscriber at SoxMachine.com. Monthly plans start at $5. We also have annual subscriptions at a discount. We have some spots open in our Veterans Committee, so if you want direct access to both Jim and James in a group chat, you can gain that by becoming part of our Veterans Committee. If interested, go to SoxMachine.com and sign up today to become a subscriber and get ad-free versions of both the podcast and the website. The Sox Machine Podcast is a production of SoxMachine.com. You're on for all things Chicago White Sox baseball and part of the Blue Wire Podcast Network. Alongside Jim Margulis and James Fegan, I'm Josh Nelson. Thanks for listening and watching.